Here he comes now, the big hand.
I'm Mr. White Christmas. I'm Mr. Snow. I'm Mr. Icicle. I'm Mr. Ten Below. Friends call me Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow in my clutch. I'm too much.
He's Mr. White Christmas, he's Mr. Snow.
That's right.
He's Mr. Icicle, he's Mr. Kendallow.
Friends call me Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow in my clutch.
He's too much.
I never wanna know a day that's over 40 degrees. I'd rather have a 30, 20, 10, 5, and then it
freezes. He's Mr. White Christmas, he's Mr. Snow.
That's right.
He's Mr. Icicle, he's Mr. Kendallow.
Friends call me Snow Miser. Too much.
Too much.
Stop by with your hubby sometime and we'll have a blizzard.
Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million. Didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up. If they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy you a house. I would buy you a house. And if I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, buy you furniture for your house. Maybe an ice Chesterfield or an ottoman. And if I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy you a K-car, a nice Reliant automobile.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
It's Christmas Eve, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Jimmy Lawler on the board. S&P futures down 4, NASDAQ futures down 20. We're gonna quiz old man Kevin here. First of all, Kevin, are you you're a big AI guy, aren't you?
I'm just the biggest.
Well, you're always talking about how good it is and all that stuff.
Well, I don't know if I'm talking about how good it is. It's what is it? It's sort of like war. You have to ask, what is it good for?
Well, you're good enough to work with
Come on, Jimmy. I'm cueing you for the war. What is it good for? You know, come on, give it to me.
Absolutely nothing. I know the song.
So the question is, could you work with Mr. Lawler and brighten up that song he played? And I say brighten up. First of all, $1 million is more shit. You got to go to $1 billion.
I did start.
What's the lottery up to now? Is it like $2 billion or something?
$1.7 billion.
Billion seven. Yes. So by you can't win if you don't play.
Yeah. But now does anybody know what a Chesterfield is?
Yeah.
It's a sort of a
couch, isn't it?
I think it's a big buffet or a china closet or something like that.
Oh, okay.
It is definitely a piece of furniture. Does anybody know what a K car is?
Oh, yeah, I get a kick out of hearing that when it says that.
Dodge. You know,
Jimmy, you remember K-Car?
Yes, I do.
Part of, Chrysler Salvation under Iacocca.
My girlfriend at the time from Allied Van Lines, the young and very attractive Gloria Schaller, had a K car. The ugliest blue I think I've ever seen in my life. But she had a K car. It ran. She got a few years. I think it was front wheel drive. She got a few years out of it. She was the niece of the guy who owned Scheller's Pump. And her dad, of course, the brothers never talked for like 30 years. Imagine that, Kevin. The brother was a judge. I think he was a U.S. judge. And his big case was he had the case where the people put the Chevy engines in the Oldsmobiles. Remember, because they didn't have enough Oldsmobile engines? Remember that story?
No, actually, I don't.
Well, there was... obviously Oldsmobile was a more expensive car, and they had a big knockout sales this one year, and they had a 350 motor. It was an Oldsmobile 350, and evidently they didn't have enough of them, so they put the Chevy 350 in the Oldsmobile, and every mechanic you talk to would say that the Chevy was a superior engine to the Oldsmobile. Yet everybody was outraged that they had a Chevy engine in their Oldsmobile. So it was this huge case, and I don't think they had to replace the engines. I don't know what they gave everybody, $1,000 a car or two or something, but that was his case, Judge Schaller.
No kidding.
Yeah. Got to talk about how wacky history is.
And a Corvette engine in it, and nobody's going to have a problem.
Because it was more expensive, even though... So guess what, Kevin, you think... There you are in the morning, getting up, minding your own business, right?
As usual,
and I pull out of the alley, pissed off that somebody's got a garbage can in my way, but that's all right. And I see this guy with his flashers on, and I'm going, and the flashers are...
You saw a flasher in the alley, huh?
No, he got his flashers on his car, and they're going slow. So I'm going, okay, what happened here? Is there somebody dead in the front seat? So I stop and look. Sure enough, the driver's side window has been bashed in. It's in front of my house. And of course I drive a little further and I see about seven or eight more all bashed in. I mean, there's merry bleeping Christmas, right? And so now I call 911. This is all before I even pick Jimmy up. And they go, oh, yeah, we'll check it out. Yeah, right. nobody's gonna know anything. But why doesn't the rest of the world, I mean, if you remember you ever watch NYPD Blue?
Sure.
When Andy Sipowicz talked about if you're the policeman in that area, you have to know your area, and if you don't, you're liable to get yourself killed or somebody else killed, because you have to understand, you have to know people's normal routine, so you don't screw it up and think it's a burglar when it's regular. The guy, I've lived in this area 22 years. The only time you have to worry about anything is on Thanksgiving and Christmas, because most of the neighborhood leaves instead of street full of cars, there's 12 cars, and everybody knows that everybody's gone. And why don't the police know that, if I know that? I mean there is... So I call 911, and the guy, yeah, we'll take it. Now, what are the chances of them calling the one car in the area and say, hey, hurry up and go up and down some of these streets, maybe those guys are still around? I give that a zero chance. Just saying.
Probably. This is the... the broken windows approach to policing is, if you take care of all the if you take care of all the small stuff, then you don't have to deal with as much big stuff.
What
you just have to be really strict on the petty crime, and because most criminals start off as petty criminals. So,
well, if the people who did this get arrested and everything, they would probably maybe you would stop the chain before it gets any higher. I don't know how close you've been watching this Chicago mayoral budget thing, but the mayor sort of caved, and the aldermanic budget is going through. So we have some people in our group that are convinced that this is the low point in Chicago, that finally the leadership has taken a turn, and they're telling this mayor enough of his stuff. But the key point in here, and I want your honest opinion and Jimmy's as well. I think
I got to give you the dishonest opinion first.
Okay, that's fair. But part of the budget is, Chicago has these massive amounts of fees they just pile on to people, but they also have, you know, water bills and things like that, and parking tickets. And I was under the impression that you could not renew your city sticker without paying your parking tickets. But evidently, all this seems to have gone the other way. I mean, even now, evidently, you can not have a city sticker for a long period of time if you park in a garage. When I know, 20 years ago, they somehow hooked up with the state and said, wait a minute. They would send you a letter saying, we know you live here. You don't have a city sticker. We're going to send this to the state, and you won't be able to get... They cracked down on this about 20 years. But anyway, the parking tickets are ridiculously expensive, okay? And a lot of people can't pay them. And the mayor had to pay his water bill before he ran for mayor, because, of course, they found out he didn't pay his water bill in how many years, Jimmy? But there's people...
Quite a few.
There's like, you know, what's the number they put out there? How many $1 million of unpaid fees and stuff are out there? Now, on the one hand, if you've got somebody in Chicago Heights who's got a house that's worth $65,000, and you send them a tax bill, I don't think this is property taxes, you send them a tax bill of $10,000, well, guess what? He's not writing a check. He hasn't had $10,000 in his life, you know, and a lot of people don't, so I'm not just disparaging anybody there. So somebody gets a $100 parking ticket, okay, and he gets 10 of them. Most people can't write a check to the city for $500 just for laughs. So now they're pushing this to some law firm, now some favored law firm, to start harassing all these people. And what do those guys get, Jimmy? 20 or 25% for collecting the stuff, a collection agency?
No, a collection agency gets anywhere from 10 to 15%. They usually buy the debt. That's the thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't they buy down the debt?
They buy it, and it depends on how old the debt is. I used to have a friend do it. Because you have up to like 7 years to collect. And then after that, you can't go after it. So they would buy it for like 12 cents on the dollar, and then they get 100% of what they get. Generally, if the city does it, they get 50%. The city gets 50%, the collection agency gets 50%. If they're under a city contract.
So there's a lot of people in the city that can't pay this stuff, and now we're going to start harassing them from some law firm. Yet there are people in the city that have this debt that, like the mayor, they just didn't pay his water bill. So I don't know where you go with that, Kevin. I'm totally up in the air with it. I don't. If somebody has the dough, yeah, I want to go get it. If they don't, I don't really want to bother them. I don't know how to even.
A lot of it is because there's a bunch of stupid fees in the first place. I have never lived anywhere else where there's a city sticker. No, there's no such thing here. You know, where I live in Michigan, there's no such thing in Indiana. There was no such thing when I lived in Wisconsin. It's an Illinois thing, where, you know, all of the cities just have an opportunity to put their hand in your pocket a little bit deeper, and you know, it's ridiculous, but. You know, I remember in my Illinois days that there were actually, you know, cops would be pulling people over. They'd spot that there wasn't a sticker in your windshield, and they'd pull you over, not even have, with no idea of, you know, what municipality was involved. And that, you know, why do we have to do this? You know, why do we have, it's not just, you know, that you need to pay for the roads in the city, the maintenance in the city, and so you're trying to match the taxes, but you're giving people one more place to go to pay their taxes. And, you know, so there's an inconvenience factor as well. Just put it in the damn property taxes, you know?
The idea that, you know, people with cars cause the city to have expenses. I mean, Indiana, you know, you gotta be careful in Indiana now. They're state sticker is way more expensive than here.
Well, I understand, and that's what I mean. You just, you know, don't give people one more place to go. Just collect it all at once.
Well, if you're
they don't do a sticker, it's part of the license. You know, it's part of getting your license plates.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I know Evergreen Park had a sticker, and boy, if you didn't have it the next day, you got a ticket in your driveway. They were on you like white on rice. It's, you know, that's why whenever people start talking about taxes and stuff, There's a gazillion taxes in this country. You can't, I mean, whenever somebody says, oh, man, half the people don't pay income taxes, well, they pay all kinds of other taxes. Nobody gets away with anything, right? So here's a money well spent on science, right? With the proliferation of all these fatso drugs, the new shots to help you lose weight, Somebody did a huge study, Kevin, and said the average person who's on one of the fatso drugs spends less on food at the store. Do they really need a big survey to come up with that conclusion? If you eat less, don't you buy less? I mean, who does this stuff? Where do we find these people?
Deep thinkers. Deep thinkers all.
So what do you got going for Christmas?
You could have AI do it for you.
Yeah.
Circling back to what you said. You know, just a comment on AI as it goes. And I've shared this with you offline, but, you know, to my way of thinking, right, the state of the art for AI as it is right now is that it does a lot of things that humans can do. It just does them faster. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And Carl's talked, and you and Carl have both talked about the externalities for running data centers for it and so on. But to me, where the state of the art is, and I've built this into courses. So, you know, I use it for like my supply chain technologies course. I'll tell you a story about that too, because I just redeveloped that in like 2 days, which was a friggin' miracle. It's all in the application. So if you just want to use AI to do queries and things like that, it's fine. It's a nice little tool. You have to check it because it has its built-in bias and it has, and it's not always accurate. And so, you know, I always tell my students, you know, use it, but never give your voice to AI because you might regret that at some point. What it's good for is doing things like helping you with demand planning, helping you build, routes for your deliveries, helping you do, I've got a whole long list of use cases. You can track your carbon footprint if that kind of thing matters to you. You can optimize it. Use it to optimize your warehouse layout. So that you're more efficient. There's all kinds of applications like that. Like I said, an individual can do that. This is just going to help you do it faster, and save you a lot of money. And it might even replace people. That's where AI is. And if I were looking to say, you know, where would I invest if I were inclined to invest in it, is I would be looking at the people that provide the apps for it. That's where I think the money is now, and that's where I think it's going to settle in for a little while, because as I once heard somebody say on one of the business channels, we're probably about 17 Nobel Prizes away from Skynet being ready to take over the world.
Well, that's what you just mentioned about routing. That is, well, when I was in grad school and the guys in what the hell is even the name of this? I was in a course of integer programming. What I was doing in there, I have no idea, but I was in it. You know what integer programming is, Kevin?
It's a familiar term. I probably did once upon a time. What is it?
Well, it's a subset of quadratic programming where the answers all have to be even numbers.
Oh, okay.
So, in other words, you can't... Quadratic programming, you do all this maximum, minimum stuff, and I used to be able to do some of this stuff, but boy, what a problem in front of me now, it'd be like Greek. Everything can come out in fractions, right, or in decimals, but if you're trying to route pilots to planes, you can't show up with half a pilot. So it's a whole different sophistication number, because everything has to be an integer. Two pilots, three pilots, one pilot, right?
Yeah.
So... the one you just mentioned was one of the most difficult problems in all of mathematics, called the salesman coloring problem. Where if you're a guy who does, say you have 50 high schools that you sell football uniforms to, and you want to go see all of them this week, deciding the quickest route to go place to place to place to place and then make it back home is one of the most difficult problems in all of mathematics. And it took like for years and years before somebody finally figured out some way to try and solve it. You needed a computer because you'd have to go from one place to the other and then pivot back to the other place. And it was kind of a max-min problem that the thing had. But it was very, very difficult to do. And for years, was pretty much unsolvable. Doesn't sound like it would be, but it is. And so when you talk about something, you see UPS does some of that, where they route people where they only have to make right turns and instead of left turns and those kinds of things. So they're down that road a little bit. But still, it's very, very difficult to do. Just saying. Not that we ever have to do that, but... Hey, what do you make of...
Let me close this out. I'll give you an example of an exercise I have the students do. So it's a technology class for non-tech people. But they need to understand what a network is, what a wide area network is, and so on. So I give them a company profile, which I had AI create for me to save me some time. But I give them the profile of an imaginary company. It's located in Ohio. It has a manufacturing facility there. It has corporate headquarters there. But it has 4 distribution centers around the country, and then plans to expand to a 5th one in Canada at some point. So that's the nutshell version of the company profile. I tell them, take that company profile, feed it into an AI engine, and ask it to create the wide area network for that company. And then, you know, it comes back with a configuration and recommendations. And now I tell the students, okay, now that you have that, I want you to look at it and tell me what concerns you have about that configuration, knowing what you know about the business, because they're supply chain students, so they know about distribution. What's your concerns in there? And generally, what I'm driving at is, do you have redundancy? Because what happens if you have a network outage and you knock one of your distribution centers offline? What is that going to do to you? I give them some cloud, you know, some cloud material so that they can decide whether they want to run their own servers or have cloud, you know, do it using an AWS or Azure. And so that's their critical thinking part, is look at this, identify the risks, and then submit that part of the assignment. And now I want you to go back to your AI engine and say, here are the risks I want you to address in this configuration. You know, go ahead and feed that back in and see what you get. Now, I think that's a good use case for AI. But really what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make my students conversant in networks so that when they deal with their IT people, they can actually have some conversations about it. So, that's what I try to build into the courses I do. It's not really high-level deep dive stuff, but by the time they get to the end of the course, they're dealing with the use cases for things like inventory management, combining it with blockchain to do traceability throughout their supply chains, transportation, warehouse layouts, things like that. And the last one I give them is it's student's choice, because I can't cover all the use cases, so they have to go get a bunch of use cases, and then they have to pick one. They have to find a company that's implemented it, and then research the company and tell me if it's been a success. Did they save? Did they scrap it? What happened there? So, you know, that's how I use it. And so when you say I'm an advocate for it, I'm an advocate for teaching my students how to use the tool.
Well, that's the whole idea, I guess, is to make things more efficient. But, it was two things. I want to get your opinion. And we're kind of walking down this road on this healthcare stuff now. We did that with the veterans for a while. And I actually got a thing from a listener yesterday that said something about, here's what you're dealing with. And I know we've brought this up. I mean, Carl kind of led us down this road, and now we're all sort of talking about it in a way where, what's the fix? And so I actually got a missive which said that you're dealing with essentially a ridiculous patent situation where people can charge way more for drugs and stuff than they ever should be able to, because they essentially have been given a monopoly on the drug. And on top of that, you've got people making decisions where they're not really paying for it because the insurance companies do. So there's no decision making there. And oh, by the way, the insurance companies are also a cartel, and they're dealing with hospitals, and they're a cartel. everybody along the line is essentially, it's like 4 cartels piled up on top of each other. And the conclusion was, there's never been a situation this bleeped up ever in the world. So, yeah. So it's, I mean, So really,
well, and you guys have had some good conversations about who's bought and paid for and who isn't, and it's interesting that as you you know, as you look at some of these, Open Secrets is a fun website because it tracks a lot of this kind of stuff. But when you look at, you know, from 1990 to 2024, who got the most money from in the Senate? Who got the most money from the healthcare industries? Do you want to, from over that time frame? So it's about a 25-year time frame. Who do you think is at the top?
Well, I don't know. I think they pretty much try and stuff everybody, but it got to be somebody who's been there the longest.
So. Joe Biden.
Okay.
But your number two? Kamala Harris. She wasn't there as long.
Wow.
Number three, Barack Obama. Number four, Hillary Clinton. Number five, Mitt Romney. Number six, Bernie Sanders. This one's interesting. Number seven, Raphael Warnock from Georgia. Warnock wasn't in the Senate until he was the 2020 election.
What makes you think the numbers only since they're in the Senate?
Oh, well, I actually if I go and say all, so I drop it down and I say top 20 members of all kinds, then you still have Biden at the top. Bernie's still there. That's not what I wanted.
Is there any correlation between the money and the committees they were in?
Oh, I'd have to really drill into that. So
was Biden on some kind of a medical committee or something?
Oh, he probably was.
Because I'm guessing that the people who are in charge of the defense committee probably get the most money from the defense people. I mean, I'm not saying it. I'm not absolving Biden at all. I'm just saying my first thought was there's got to be a connection between who pays you and what committee you're in.
Yeah,
or, so especially if you're running it.
Yeah, well, yeah, and
was Biden ever a committee chair?
Probably. He was judiciary, wasn't he?
I thought Durbin's been judiciary for a long time. I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm saying that's why I'm asking, because I would guess if I'm a farmer organization, I'm going to give money to the guy who's the head of the agricultural committee and not necessarily to the judicial committee. Why would I do that?
No. So some of it is based on longevity. So if you've been around forever, you're likely to be high on the list. And that would be, you know, your McConnells and McCains and people like that that show up. But then there's others that, you know, weren't nearly as long, you know, like Ossoff, Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney didn't spend a lot of time in Congress in any form until not too many years ago, and yet he's right up there at the top. As you look down to this, but I always get a kick out of Sanders because, you know, Bernie's for the little guy, of course.
Yeah. This is so complicated. Now, are we talking about contributions to the campaign fund? Are we talking the PAC, or what are we talking?
We're talking the campaign funds. In this case, it looks like it's directly to the candidates.
Well, the Democrats, the money goes to the candidate, doesn't really go to the party. That's kind of the difference between the way the two parties. I mean, the party's trying to get money from the candidates on the Democratic side. It's kind of weird. I mean, they're pretty different, the two parties.
It is interesting. We can break it out by year too. So when I look at the 2023-24. If you look at the macro, it's pretty even for the parties. If you're looking at the party contributions for just that year, it's about twice as much to Democrats as Republicans, which is interesting. So it means that somewhere along the line that shifted. Let's see what I can. Let me back that up.
I don't care. Don't just
back,
run by
let
that
me
one.
Back that up to 2010. That was about 50-50 to the parties.
Okay, but you're talking about individual people from the parties.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to take a stab because of the way the two parties are set up, and the Republican Party is a hell of a lot more organized. I'm going to say that the people who got all the money for like the seven vaccines, and without just off the top of my head, they're much more likely to give some money to the Republican National Committee than anybody is to give it to the Democratic National Committee. So I don't know that you can necessarily, in other words, I think you need to include that number in what the individual people get to get a true feel for who's getting what where.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's probably in here somewhere, and I'm just not looking at it. But, you know, I have to spend a little time. You don't want me doing that.
Just a question.
It's also interesting, when you look at 2024, they have the contributions to all candidates on here, and that's about 50-50 incumbents versus other candidates, non-incumbents, I would say. If I back it up to 2010, it was almost all going to incumbents in the election cycle.
Well, because incumbents used to always win. Now they don't.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So that, you know, that's interesting as well. But anyway, yeah, you can sit there and play with it, you know, and you can look up different industries on there too.
In the immortal words of one of our buddies from college, when the mayoral election in Chicago actually was a real election, gotta hate it when that happens. I gotta give money to both sides.
Yeah, how about it? Now let's see. You know, I can take a look at. I'm assuming that communications and electronics would include all of our tech businesses, so we can look at that. A 2024 election cycle. You know, Asana, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Amazon. Those are the big contributors there. Oracle shows up. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Is seventh in the 2023-24 election cycle. But we should look at money to Congress there. And
Do you remember, I'm going to change the subject again, keep going, but do you remember, I think we were just starting the show, Kevin, and Microsoft, which had been the happy monopolist in my mind, I mean, those guys, in my opinion, have broken the Sherman Act more than anybody. They're just doing all of a sudden they got in trouble. Remember this? They got in trouble with some antitrust kind of crap. And Bill Gates evidently was always, you know, he was going to be holier than thou. He wasn't really into this politic, giving people money stuff, the lobbyist stuff. And he took so much crap from financial TV and other people, shareholders. Bill's got to wake up. He has to understand this is the way the game is played. You got to buy these people off, this kind of stuff. The American public that had their investment in Microsoft was beating the crap out of the guy because he didn't buy people off. And then all of a sudden, Microsoft started to become a big lobbyist and everything else, and now they're in the game and everybody's happy, right? Maybe you and I aren't, but some people are.
Yeah. So, I'm looking at the communications and electronics companies, and I'm just trying to figure out when this turned, because that's been skewed very heavily towards Democrats. And it looks like the 2013-14 election cycle, it was pretty close to even. Let's look one more back on this one, just to see what we have here. 2012 was a little heavier, you know, it was probably 60-40 to Democrats. And
well, they all end up with the same amount of dough. So who's giving it to Republicans? Individual people?
Well, yeah, or different industries.
Just
That's been skewed to Democrats for a while, but the last few election cycles, it's been overwhelmingly the Democrats from the tech sector, and that'll be interesting to see how that changes next time around, with Trump in office and with the amount of stuff he's been doing with tech sector businesses. That may very well change this next election cycle and be closer to even.
Well, where do you count, excuse me, where do you count, who's the lady that just gave Trump the $200 million or something, or $250? Where does that
Adelson.
Adelson. And does that come from her? Where does that get counted?
Well, I'd have to see where that goes, because that's going to exceed individual limits, you know, contribution limits. So where is that contribution really going?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Where's it really going?
I think it's going to his PAC.
Okay.
She has promised it if he runs again, and she wants basically him to allow Israel to take over the West Bank. She is Israeli, if you didn't know. Sheldon Adelson's.
That's interesting.
Wife, they are both very, very pro-Israel. Feels, you know, she came out and blatantly said it on mic. Usually I think you would want to say that in private.
Well, I'd rather have her say it in public, frankly.
Well, yeah. I do remember it when somebody was waving the big flag on term limits a while ago, and somebody wrote some article, or whatever it was, sent it to me, they didn't write it and sent it to me. They found it and sent it to me. And saying how the drug companies were trying to identify up-and-comers in either party at the state level, like the guys who, you know, are young, that are already making a name for themselves in, like, the Illinois State Senate, the Michigan State Senate, and that might run for something else, like the Irish girl was running for senator in Michigan. You know, that she was, you know, wasn't at the end of the bench, and she's got some talent, some ambition. They're already dropping the number down to where they were greasing people at that level. So once you get the first check into somebody, pretty hard to say no, right? But you've been listening to the theme. What we're going on here is we know, without anybody's, I guess if you look just at the numbers, without any sort of solution to anything, you look at what Carl's telling us. Within 4 or 5 years, the medical stuff is going to overwhelm people's ability to pay and the government's ability to pay. And, oh, by the way, it's going to be so expensive that people aren't even going to get the care they're supposed to be getting, which is already happening now, if you ask me. So
yeah, I think we're there. Yeah,
I think we're there. So the question is, how do you bring all this back in? I mean, how do you – and I'm always Mr. Cost Accountant, which nobody knows what that is anymore. I just say, I don't care who pays for what. If you're paying – $10 for something that costs 2 cents, you got a problem. And you got to find a way. If that costs $1, guess what? You don't have a problem, no matter who pays for it, the person, the insurance company, whatever. And the same way with hospitals. And yet every day there seems to be one taking over another one. The doctors, they're not independent anymore. They have to do what somebody else says. They have to prescribe the drugs that their group says they got to subscribe. And it's just a big mess. And it looks like it can't just keep going on like this. Now, the question is, if we all from the show or the listeners could all get in a big room and say, here's the first 5 steps, what would they be? And I maybe Russell or Larissa has it could be something, and I would say really, really simple, stupid, and I'm not even sure if they're good. You know, drop the patents from 17 years to 12. No, I don't think.
Yeah, I'd make it 5, but okay.
Well, whatever. So I mean, is that one of the solutions? I don't know.
It's a piece of it.
It's 5% of it, maybe. Maybe because they just gouge more into 5 years, knowing they only have to gouge for 5. I don't know. You know, but you got to ask.
That's true, but they don't get to gouge forever, so that's a help.
Well, I go back to, you're a little younger than me, but you probably remember. I mean, I know that my aunts and grandparents used to tell me that in the late 40s, early 50s, this idea of polio was, you know, your kid's going to have to spend the rest of his life in an iron lung, that kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of crummy diseases around, but that one was about as crummy as it gets. You're talking about a paralyzed kid to the point where you can't even use your chest muscles to breathe. Well, that's a rough life. And somebody invents, Jonas, was it Salk, invented the polio vaccine. And even if you only have to take it once, Kevin, how many years pay would your dad or my dad have paid to get you or me a polio shot? I mean, it comes down to is it a moral issue? Is it a cost issue? I mean, what is it? Okay, somebody has something that all of a sudden everybody needs, and it costs you $2 to make. I guess, as Hal would say, it's a supply curve that is inelastic, shall we say. Hey, guess what? It's $5,000, $10,000. It's $2. Do you ever want to give anybody that sort of pricing power? It's so against anything that we, you know, any kind of competitive sort of model. Do you give somebody a patent for it, or do you just say, here's the formula that anybody can go make it, which essentially is not what anybody probably wants if somebody else went through the time and trouble to do it. Yet you look at the drugs that come out for patent, and you see people like Katie was on the show. They don't get any part of the patent, and she's working on it. If you and I donate to the drug, we don't get part of the patent. The hospital, that you know, probably sucks money out of it, but still, it's their place where it gets. They don't get any money out of it. All of a sudden, somebody else says, "Oh, I'm going to charge you a bazillion dollars for 17 years." I mean, the whole system just stinks, you know. And I guess going from 17 to 12 or 5 is, you know, it's something. But there's a million variables we've talked about, and that's just one of the stuff. Then on top of that, you talk about the insurance companies, and they're all getting together, and they totally ignore the idea that the hospitals are supposed to give everybody the same price on stuff, which they don't. I mean, I tell you what, I don't know if I'd want to be part of that. It's like trying to solve the college football morass. How are we doing with that? I mean, these are pretty big problems.
A big part of the problem, and this is a big cost driver since Obamacare went in, was. Is that we've kind of bastardized what insurance really means. And it's been this way for a long time. This is not new. We've had, you know, all kinds of health maintenance organizations and so on that do this forever. And by forever, I mean, you know, since I was a young employee, you know, and that became an option. But, you know, what really we've done is we've made insurance into prepaid health care. As opposed to, you know, insurance is there to handle, you know, your catastrophes and to smooth out, you know, to smooth out the really painful stuff. And when I say it became a cost driver with Obamacare, it became a big cost driver because we stopped giving people a choice about that. We went and said, no, it's mandated. Here's what you have to do. You have to run this prepaid healthcare model. And that wound up, you know, meaning that, you know, we're paying for your office visit and we're paying for, you know, some of the most routine stuff where if I wanted to, I could say I can afford, you know, the first $2,000, $1,000, whatever it is, the high deductible. And I don't need you to cover, you know, when I go to the doctor because I have a bad cold or something. I need you to cover when I have a heart attack. I think that's what insurance originally was. That's what it was back when my kids were born, for example. You know, insurance covered a lot of the hospital stuff, but there was an out-of-pocket amount that I paid. And now there's people who, you know, a lot of the political world believes, no, it shouldn't cost you anything to go into the hospital and have a kid.
Shouldn't cost you anything extra. It's always going to cost you somewhere.
Yeah, if you go in and there's complications, that's different. I think we've made insurance into a prepaid healthcare plan where, you know, I get to go to the doctors, I get this many doctor visits, I get, you know, et cetera. And I just think that's an expense model that just is not sustainable.
Well, it starts, or maybe doesn't start, but it stems in some ways from it's tax deductible for the business and not for the person.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is insanity to start with.
Well, so, and that's part of that, you know, the proposal that's back out there that says if you can buy insurance out of your health savings account, then that's a pre-tax deduction that allows you to pay for insurance. And I do think that's a good idea.
Well, okay, but then it comes down to if it's tax deductible for you, I'd much rather. I mean, this is just, you know, taking all the bullshit out of it, it's if I'm, you know, for PTI, when we used to have, you know, 15 people here, somebody would say, look, I'd rather you pay up for this plan instead of giving me $1,000 a year raise. You pay up for the plan, so when I go to the doctor, or the eye doctor, 10 times this year, $1,000 comes out of your pocket instead of mine because you can deduct it and I can't. And then on top of that, you have some groups back in the day, which we seem like we're totally jettisoning this idea, that if we get people to go often to the doctor and get their checkups, then the cost over their lifetime is less because we're going to catch something early. So we're going to encourage you to get your annual physical, and oh, by the way, we'll pay for it. Because we really don't want 5 years from now something that should have been caught 5 years ago, run up a bill of $200,000. So there's a lot of stuff that enters.
I totally get that, Tom. I think it's a sensible cost argument. I just think consumers should get to choose which coverage they get.
Consumers are going to choose the world's best plan at the world's best company, and that's how they make their hiring decisions. Right?
Say that again.
I mean, part of everybody. If any one of us needed a job, if you didn't have a job, and I didn't have a firm, I mean, part of your interview process when you're picking between place A and place B is the health insurance. Right? It's part of your salary now, and it's even weirder that if you walk into some, you know, say I walk into a, I'm not a lawyer, but you know, some high-end law firm that has this massive Cadillac plan, I don't even call them that anymore, and I say, okay, we're going to pay you, Chief, we're going to pay you $200,000 a year to be a lawyer, and I'm like, and oh, by the way, you get this insurance, which is worth $3,000 a month, probably. The weird part is, if I say, well, don't worry, my wife's a judge, I'm covered by over there, they don't say, okay, not, we'll add the $35,000 to your $36,000 to your salary, which they should, right? But I don't know.
Theoretically.
I mean, it's the whole thing is really jumbled up, and I think the jumble is, I think we're agreeing on that, part of the jumble is that it's tax deductible for one and not the other. I mean, if I go to the dentist and I get my teeth cleaned,
so it should either be tax deductible for everybody or nobody, and I agree with that. Now, if we, you know, Hal was advocating for, you know, your Walmarts and Costcos and people like that to be able to sell insurance, and damn, Costco sells everything else. They might as well sell insurance, and they, you know, actually they do for other kinds of insurance. It's just the healthcare insurance that you can't get there. I don't really have a problem with that. I mean, that's just a different variation on group, you know, getting group rates, is what it is. And you know, you should have, you know, any group should be able to get your group rates, and they do. You know, you join AARP, you can get group insurance rates. So I don't have a problem with that. It's just, you know, who is allowed to do it and who's going to do it effectively becomes your discussion item.
Well, the two things, somehow, I think, if I was going to start somewhere, I would say some place it has to start with the patents. Just because you have a patent, whether you stole it from other people or not, which I think most of the time that's what happens, when you do that, there's got to be some limit on how much. I mean, if you're charging, you know, $10 for a pill that costs you 50 cents to make, there's got to be some place. And boy, you know, I hate to hell up with the government in the middle of this. That says, you know what? We're going to let you gouge. We're going to go out for bid on making this stuff, and we're going to give you idiots $1 a pill, and that's it for having the formula. But if somebody else can make it for 50 cents, and we can sell it for $2.50, we're not charging people $10. So I can't even begin to be the person to come up with that formula. But somehow or another, that has to happen.
So maybe a royalty type of fee for
right.
it instead of a patent, similar to what you do with music.
Right. And the other thing is, you got to stop this multi-tier pricing with these hospitals.
Yeah.
Remember back in the day where, when you were out of state, if you busted a finger playing softball and you went to an emergency room in Phoenix. You weren't even covered because they didn't have the network there. These side deals people make. I mean, I don't want to tell the story again. I've told it about 10 times of one of our original clients. He used to self-insure his whole factory. Well, as soon as the network thing came in, he couldn't do that. There's no way he could pay $20,000 for an appendectomy if somebody else is paying $5,000. I mean, somehow that has to change. But you know, you look at we're not zeroing in on this at all, Kevin. Here are the who's the guys here? What the hell, I just saw the Supreme, Sanofi to acquire hepatitis B vaccine maker Dynavax for $2.2 billion. You know, if this is the one that actually is the cure, what is that? It's a 26 or 30 week program, and it's $2,000 a week or something, or $1,500 a week. Well,
something like that, yeah.
Now they're worth $2.2 billion because what do you suppose? I mean, I don't think somebody's wrestling an alligator in the Amazon to get this you know, to get the potion for this. What do you suppose that costs? $1,000 a week. You know, 100, 50, 10? I don't think it's 950, do you?
Well, yeah, and you know, I don't mind him, you know, putting the upfront investment on some kind of schedule and saying that's part of my cost recovery. That, you know, that's pretty standard, you know, anywhere in the world. But you do get back to the question of how long do you get that protection, and really what's the payback? The theory behind it, in at least in part, is, well, you're not just paying for that, you're paying for all the research that doesn't find a market.
Bullshit.
And
bullshit.
Okay, so you know, I get that too, but that's just favoring an industry then. And you know, are we consciously saying we're doing that because we want this industry to thrive?
I don't get the charge
that because they just do such a nice job of paying off Congress.
I don't get the charge $50 a share because of all the thought I went into picking that stock. Saying.
Well, and you don't get to charge to recover anything like if you were getting paid, and you don't get paid to recover anything that you recommended or that you bought that wasn't a winner.
Or the time I spent looking at a stack and then going, nah, not that one. But now, yeah. Now I can't wait to hear Sanofi's going to buy these guys, right? I can't wait because you know what's going to happen for Sanofi to get in front of Congress and say they have to charge this amount because of all the research they did. Looks to me like they didn't do any. Did they?
No, they're going to buy the research.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, okay. I think we're beating it up, and we're trimming around the edges on all of this, where we really have to, you know, it needs a good, you know, step back, do a whole appraisal of what should a healthcare payment system look like, and that's a much longer exercise.
Well, but it's the increasing chunk of the national expenses is reaching the point. It's going faster and faster and faster. Where it's not something we can talk about 30 years from now. That I think is our message. But hey, I got to just on a we got a few minutes, and Russell can pile in if he wants. What do you make of, you know? And this is not. I guess I can be political on it because I where it's going, I think I know where it's going, but the idea now we're going to have this policy going forward of basically seriously easy money, which we've been sneakily doing now for probably 25 years, but now we're actually putting it on the front burner, and we've got, you know, Hassett coming out and saying we're way behind the loop and the interest rate's got to be lower. Now, I would hope by now that 90% of the population, or 80 or 50, would understand really what he's saying. What they're saying is they're going to pour enough money into the system so that money becomes cheaper to get in the short term. Okay, and when the more money you put in, the less a dollar becomes in terms of value to something else. And you end up with inflation, or you should, or whatever. Of course, they're not going to give us the numbers, it doesn't appear, or maybe won't. And who that benefits and who it doesn't. And it's real interesting, Kevin. I don't think I'm the only person who's figured this out. You start talking about, I mean, ask yourself some simple questions. If you have that point of view, if you're part of the asset holding class, and there's a lot of people 401k, so it's not like it's nobody. It's not just Trump. I mean, how many people 401ks in this country? Gazillions, right? So there's a lot of people. Everybody we're listening to, and maybe you and me are a part of the asset holding class to a certain extent. So it's not all bad for everybody in terms of blowing up asset prices. But for some people, it's sort of not. But look at when you see the prices being paid for football and baseball teams, and you look at, you know, the view of the world, you look at somebody's willing to buy 50% of, you know, Memphis, Wisconsin, Notre Dame's athletic program. And you sit there and go, why the hell would anybody want to do that? Because why would you pay for something that's got $200 million in revenue and maybe he's making, you know, 20 or 30? Why would somebody put a price tag on that of, you know, $4 billion or something, or $3 billion? You sit there and it doesn't match. Well, if you look at the view and you say this is going to be the formula for the government for the next 20 years, you're going to see that Notre Dame ticket price in the year 2036 being $1,000 or $800 or $750 or something. Cause, and you're going to say, the money I paid for this thing is going to be chump change come then. It's going to be...
Well, you may see it at that time, but you may not, because there gets to be a point where people will not pay for it, and if that shows up also in media rights and things like that, to where we already have this discussion all the time with Major League Baseball and their how the networks they use are such a moving target, that at some point your consumer says no. And that that's just the way it is, and we've talked about that.
But that's the theory.
I talked about it in terms of tariffs, that we already see that in manufacturing, where a lot of industries are saying, sorry, your costs are higher, but that manufacturer is your problem, not mine.
Right, but I
don't get value out of I don't get any more value because your costs are high.
Well, if you're marketing corn or soybeans, and this is where I think the professors of the world, and I'm going to include myself in there, this is where you got to kind of move from the theory a little bit. Which is, you're 100% right, Kevin. I should never say that. A, because it goes to your head, and B, it's bad radio. You're 100% right.
That everybody knows it's true. So.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but the idea that everybody's not going to be brought along to be able to pay the $800 or $900 for the Notre Dame ticket or the Bears ticket. I get that, all right? Especially if you do it in such a way you're going to leave 75% to 80% of the population in the dirt, basically. But so what? There's still going to be enough 1%ers coming out of Notre Dame to sell 80,000 tickets a week, because they're going to be the people that benefit from this. There's always going to be 60,000 people in Chicago that somehow or another are going to pony up their money to go to their one or two Bear games a year. It becomes such a selective market. You're right. If they were,
but I'll tell you right now that they don't have the 80,000 every week anymore. They do have games that don't sell out. They do have games where they're sitting here advertising locally, saying, "Yeah, we're putting them on sale for cheap for you to get into this game." So you're already hitting the price point where people, and the price point includes game times, travel times. Who's going to come in for a whole weekend and so on? That's already showing up.
All right, I'm going to disagree here. There, I'm going to say it's not the price point of the ticket. It's the price point of the total lack of any kind of convenience for the person coming in.
That's a big part of it, yeah. But it is also the price point of, because they have basically made it difficult for the day trippers to continue to come, and that for a long time was what filled the stadium, was the people who could come in for the day, and now you're telling them, well, it's a night game, or it's a, it's a 3:30 Eastern game. So you're not going to get home until really late. There's been a discouragement factor there, but it's also, you always have had the alumni who come in, make their annual trip to come and see a game. And when you start looking at the overall pricing of the weekend now, the cost of a hotel locally, cost of a crappy hotel locally is through the roof. And then on top of that, they're going to require a minimum number of days, so you can't even, you can't even escape without at least a two-night minimum, and so the whole experience is getting priced out of the market.
All right. And, what you're doing,
and we're seeing that.
What you're doing is, it's very. How would you like to be an economics professor today, like hell? How can you stay on topic? I'm going to say, and this is something we can never, that if Notre Dame or anybody said, screw TV, every game is going to be 1 o'clock, and everybody's welcome to be a day tripper. I think you can double the ticket prices tomorrow, and you got buyers.
You might, but it's going to screw up their revenue model.
Well, okay, but
you're going to get the day trippers because you don't have the weekend.
But now they've decided that the restaurant
issues.
They're beating the crap out of the studio audience, which is the people in the stands. To the point where, you can't fill it up, because guess what? I'm not doing a 7:30 game to watch some crummy team in December or November in South Bend. I'm not doing that. So, yeah, it doesn't matter if the ticket's $5 or $500 at that point.
So yeah, although they did sell out the playoff game last year in December.
Yeah, well, look at the people they had from Indiana, too. I mean, it was a huge road crowd. I wonder if they'd have sold that out if their people were from... They might have, but if everybody was from Oregon, you think they would have done as well?
I mean, I was curious as to whether they would or not on that one, and had some discussions. But, you know, my impression, and it might have been the novelty of the first time, that won't necessarily continue. My impression from last year was that, they'd sell it out.
Not probably.
The Notre Dame people would do it. I didn't think, you know, I thought it would be difficult to get people to travel as much as they needed them to on short notice during the holiday season. But that proved to not be true.
Well, my Audrey's one of her best friends, and I have to get her on the show someday. Kathy's a terrific lady. She's a trader on the floor, and she's been in the beverage industry. She, Notre Damer, loves the place. And last year her nephew ponied up tickets for the playoff game and all the way down there and dinner and the whole bit, and that was her Christmas present. She loved it. Now, whether she'd do it 2 years in a row, I don't know. But for one time, she thought it was great.
Yeah.
Hey, all this stuff, isn't it, it's interesting talk, though, isn't it? Because what is everybody's view of the future? I mean, if the current administration, by the way, other administrations have done this, they're just looking to take it to the next level. If they start pouring money into the system and, you know, telling people there isn't any inflation, Kevin, what do you think if they do that and other people after them do that, if we're going to live 30 years and we put $1 million into the 30-year band, 30 years from now they send us a check for the $1 million, what do you expect that $1 million to be worth 30 years from now? I got it worth like nothing.
About $100.
Yeah, same money. Good Lord. You better be getting like 12% interest along the way, and they're not. They're getting 4. Actually, it's 4.8. That's not enough, is it?
The economic theory in the past has been, well, if we can grow out of some of this, but it's going to take a lot of growth to do that.
Well, whenever Russell piles in here, back in the day, when you talk about the inverted yield curve, when I first started, the 30-year rate was about 12.5%. I think the low tick on the bonds, now for those that don't know, there is actually, when the 30-year bond trades, there's actually one bond that is trading. Okay, there's some specific bond, and at the time it was an 8.5% bond. Okay, so when you price interest rates on bonds, if it traded at exactly 100, then the interest going forward for that bond you just bought would be 8.5%, because that was the coupon. But if you could buy it at like 90, what does that mean? Now the 8.5% number you got on the 100 is only going to be on the 90, so your actual interest rate you're going to get of what you paid is probably 9.7 or something, somewhere in there. Well, that bond traded, I think the low tick, Kevin, was like 66.5, which means that the interest rate is probably another third up, so 12.5, which is just about what you would expect, right? So if an 8.5% bond coupon that came out at 100 trades for 66, 67, you're going to end up with 12.5%, or a little more probably. But now, that's kind of not happening. So it's a different world. You're not maintaining the inflation like you did in those days. So when you could look at that and say, all right, I'm stumbling here a little bit, because the mentality was, we, meaning the U.S. of A., the citizens, the government, nobody wanted that. All right, so someplace, somewhere, whether it was Volcker, whether it was Superman, whether it was Kevin O'Neill, whether it was Hal Snyder, whoever it was, we're gonna find a way to fix this over the next few years. And the short-term rate was 15 or 16, and the long-term rate was 12. So the opinion was, of everybody, the market and everybody, we're not gonna let this shit happen for the next 30 years. Somewhere along the line, we're gonna fix this. But now it's different. I think the powers to be, and I'm not it's not just Trump, it's been going on certainly since 2020. The powers to be is we're this class that makes money on this crap. This is great. And the COVID message was you can't say COVID wasn't a depression. Nobody was working. The place was shut down and the market was going up every day because we're pouring money in the system. The lesson that was learned there, Kevin, is a lesson that might take us down because everybody thinks this is just great. I got stock, pour money in, my stock goes up, I'm rich, I don't care about the rest of you people. That's a bad message going forward, and I don't think there's any disagreement, you and I, that's the message that's out there.
Well, that's not only is it the message that's out there, it's the it's the World Economic Forum point of view as articulated in the book The Great Reset by Klaus Schwab. We talked about COVID-19 being the catalyst for a great reset of how the economy is built, and it's very much built around an enlightened class that is going to tell the rest of us what's best for us.
And
it's right out there for anybody who wants to read it.
It's not just out there to read. It's been human history. The whole idea of a middle class. Kevin, if we're not going to be here, maybe there's a heaven, you and I, or hell, or someplace where you and I can sit there having a cocktail. 500 years from now, we may look back and say, middle class, a phenomenon that occurred in the U.S. of A. and maybe in Europe between the years 1948 and 1985. That could be the definition of middle class. Name me one other time. Maybe early Rome, maybe, when you actually got a hunk of silver for a day's work. That didn't last very long either, did it? Name me any other time in any other society where there actually was a middle class.
Good question. Yeah.
It's a phenomenon that if we don't realize how valuable that is and work to save it, and that's exactly not the direction we're going, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter. That's not where we're going. We can't wait to get rid of it and have people up top who think they should be up top running the place. It's a plutocracy, and I don't really know.
In many cases, it's people who at least think they're doing right by everybody. You have your evil masterminds, of course, but you also have your people who just think they're the great philosopher kings, who really are looking out for all of our best interests, and of course they're not.
The Lord helps the man who helps himself,
Yeah, no kidding.
Do we have we have no guys? No Russell, no Larissa?
No, we don't. I can hang with you for a while, though.
Or what's
we need to talk about the NFL.
Yeah. Look at the difference. You've been our stalwart guy, you and Lou. The Bears actually have a couple guys that are on the All-Pro team this year. A center and a guard.
And a safety.
Yeah, but I'm saying last year, the three interior linemen could have been the worst that ever played as a group, and the team absolutely sucked. And Detroit probably had three of the best guys. Center retired, but the guard got hurt, and now the Bears have the three guys in the middle that are really good, and they haven't gotten hurt, thank God, knock on wood. And all of a sudden, look at the difference in the team. Duh.
It's huge. And you have a coach whose philosophy fits that too, which he did in Detroit. The same thing. But his philosophy is we're going to run first, because there are a lot of coaches out there who aren't. You have to have a running game of some sort, but they're more of a mind that it's all about passing, and that's just not the case with the Bears, and it's one of the things I like actually.
Yeah, but you gotta be
because I am very fond of a good running game.
Well, if you go back to the Vince Lombardi was a genius. Okay, he had Forrest Gregg at his left tackle, and he had two guards that were as fast as the halfbacks. Guess what? The guy ran sweeps all. If he didn't notice that, he'd have to be the dumbest man on earth, wouldn't he? For God's sake, We've got a really good offensive line. I think we'll run the ball. Duh.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, Tom. But, you know, a lot of the shift that we've seen in the approach to offense, some of that, you know, started with the West Coast offense, yeah. And, you know, that Walsh was kind of the leading proponent with the 49ers. And a lot of that was built around, you know, how do we protect quarterbacks? So it was about getting the ball out quickly. And, you know, passing is still very much about that. But the other thing is that has, you know, that has driven coaches to think that way and to learn to ignore the, you know, ignore is not the right word, to minimize, you know, the running attack, or to de-emphasize running in favor of passing, is that you're not allowed to touch a receiver after 5 yards. If you can't cover the guy, there's a good chance he's going to be open. So, you know, that's sort of driven people. But I also think that defenses, like, you know, like they always do, have started to adapt to the point where they say, okay, what are we going to do? They've learned to disguise their coverages and such, and try and bait the quarterbacks into making bad decisions. And so, you know, that's the spy versus spy stuff that's going on. It's interesting to watch it evolve, but I am very much, you know, to me, I have always liked if you have the ability, especially when the game's on the line, when you're just trying to protect a lead, and you have the ability to just say, you know what, I'm going to tee it up, I'm going to run, I'm going to hold the ball for the last 5 minutes of the game, there's not a damn thing you can do to stop it.
Or if your quarterback has to do the 2-minute drill, he can't do it looking up at the sky. You know,
how much have we seen that with the Bears?
Yeah. Well,
remember when they traded for Jay Cutler?
Yeah, the poor guy. Well, Harbaugh, how bad did Harbaugh get beat up?
Well, yeah, but in Cutler's, you know, age, they paid a big price for him, a couple of first-round draft picks and probably more than that. So they pay this big price for the guy, and they never got him an offensive line. That guy, he wasn't the, you know, the most charming guy in the world, so a lot of people didn't like him, but damn, he spent so much time, exactly as you said, looking up at the sky. Even if he wasn't sacked, he was getting beaten up. And, you know, why would you make that kind of an investment into a quarterback and never get him a blocker? Well, never get him anybody to block for him.
Just
and
a little bit of what we're talking about. If you go back, and I was looking on this thing on YouTube, Ditka was talking about the toughest guys he ever played against. And in those days, your tight end essentially was the tight end. The other guy was a split end, and then you would put one of the three guys in the backfield. They called him a flanker. They put him out so it looked like you had two split ends, but really one was an end and one was your halfback, and the tight end was the guy that was inside. Now, if you wanted to keep the hard part about guys like Ditka, why they had to be so tough, the tight ends had to be big guys, was you'd put a linebacker over them. And a linebacker would just make sure, on one hand, the tight end's trying to block somebody in the running game, but on the other hand is you just annihilate the guy all the way to the first 10 yards, and you never let him get in the pattern. You just tie him up at the line of scrimmage. You got to be a Hulkman just to get free to run your pattern.
Yeah, bump and run.
Well, but tight end was more than bump and run. You just annihilate him. But then all of a sudden now you have guys like Olsen, who's a terrific commentator and was a really good tight end. But he was never a tight end. In the old, he always split out 4 or 5 yards.
He was always flexed. He was always in motion. You know, whatever.
So he never had to worry about some monster linebacker beating the crap out of him every play to not even let him get in the pattern. He's now like a wide receiver, like you say. Maybe you try and bump him in the first 5 yards, but after that, he's home free. So it's a whole different world than the '60s football. In that regard. So now you have 3-4 people in the pattern, and the only reason why you have to keep somebody in is if your line can't block and you need help blocking. The difference between having 3 guys in the pattern and 4 or 5, Kevin, there's 5 guys in the pattern, I won't say, you and I would a little work could make a stab at playing quarterback. If we got 3 guys in the pattern, we're going home, right? Yep. It's a whole difference in the world. It either all works or it doesn't. Everybody's bitching about Kelce and how he's not making as many catches this year. Look at him. With their offensive line, the guy's blocking half the time. He's not even in the pattern. How are you going to catch the ball if you're not in the pattern?
One of the best blockers is blocking for the Bears now.
Yeah. It's a, I mean, that team is – they're 7-8 people away now from being as good as they were, I think. Kansas City, they're not even close.
And they're also, you know, it's starting to catch up on them that they've been drafting farther down the draft. I think that matters.
Yeah. Where did New England get all these people? I mean, I never get to watch them because they've been so lousy for so long. They're not in any of the national TV games. I don't ever get to watch them, and I never watch Seattle. Nobody puts them on national TV games either. But those two teams are really tough, and I haven't watched either one of them.
Well, we're seeing the same thing. You know, this is partly with the Bears too, because a lot of the people are. You know, we credit a lot to getting the offensive linemen and to picking up some other good veterans, but also the last few years they had. You know, when Ryan Poles first started, and we can talk about that for a minute too, because that I think that's an interesting case study. But his last couple of drafts have been really good. So they're starting to fill in the blanks. You know, you look at some of these guys who are, you know, that took them a little while to get going, whether it was Colston Loveland or Ozzie Trapillo or so. You know, those guys, you know, Loveland's the tight end for the listeners.
Kevin, did those guys come out as juniors or not?
Loveland, I think, was a senior. Trapillo, I think, you know, came, you know, I'd have to check. But, you know, my point with them is, that you start stockpiling those guys as well, and you do that a few years in a row, you know, you're getting that with Tyreek Stevenson, who was, you know, because of work ethic and some of those kinds of things I don't even know if work ethic's the right word with Stevenson. He's the guy who probably cost him the Washington game last year with the Hail Mary pass, and there he was out, you know, taunting the crowd before that play and in Washington and so on. So, you know, he left a bad taste in people's mouths. He's grown up to become a very good cornerback. You know, so you start seeing guys like that who, you know, even though you draft them, you know, they're not your first round draft picks, like a Darnell Wright, who, you know, got in and started right away at right tackle. But they're not your first round draft picks, but they're good football players. They just take half a year to a year, maybe even a little more than that, to really be NFL starter ready. But they become really good starters for you. I think you're seeing a lot of that too, and that you're seeing that with the Bears. I think that's what you're seeing with the Patriots as well.
Well, the Bears used to have
and Drake May. You know, they drafted Drake May. That quarterback class with that Caleb Williams is in is looking pretty darn good as a group. And, you know, Drake May's been terrific for them. He's from North Carolina. I remember seeing him in college.
Well, the thing, there was a time, and I could go back and look at it now, but I spent some time over, it was about an 8-year period, Kevin, maybe even a decade, where it was, it's when Aaron Rodgers was young and the Packers were real good and they had that really good offensive line and everything. And it's kind of the same time that the Bears got, who's the quarterback you just mentioned, the guy from Denver?
Jay Cutler.
Yeah, Cutler. They end up, they gave so many draft picks away. But the Bears have given away, used 8 number one draft picks on quarterbacks in the last, 15 years, 20 years? I mean, no other team's done that.
Defensive ends.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. But there were periods of time in there where the Packers had, I'll say, there's 7 rounds. The Packers had an average of like 8 or 9 picks, and the Bears had an average of like 4. Because they gave them away, you know, and they just traded them away. So, this table was still on your team, a starter in the rotation, special teams, you know, or it could have been another team, or out of football. And the Packers, like, virtually every year, there'd be like 2 or 3 starters, like, on their team. Somebody else is contributing for, like, another team. And maybe only, 2 out of the 8 were out of football. I mean, they were playing somewhere, doing something on somebody's team, even with special teams for, you know, the Rams or something. And yet the Bears, there'd be like 4 picks, and a year or two later, 3 of them are like out of football. You know, they're not playing for anybody, let alone, you know, even if they're a star for the Rams, you might say, well, at least we got another couple of picks for them, another couple of guys. They were like nobodies. And you look at the difference and you go, no wonder every position, the Packers at one point had something like 32 guys on their team that they drafted, or 35 or something. And the Bears, you know, had like, you know, nowhere near that. So you look at the, all you do is look at that page and you go, God, how can you even compete with these guys? And by the way, they didn't, did they? So now you're right. All of a sudden now the guys are getting in the third or fourth round. Even if they don't start, they're not starting for the Bears, they're contributing someplace. They're a punt returner or on another team, special team. They're at least way up, much better players than that period, a 10-year period back in the day. And the team's better because of it. You're right. I mean, it shows. But that was one period there where their drafts were abysmal. It was like a decade long.
You have to have not only good starters, but you have to have guys who can step in when you need them to play. And, you know, the Bears haven't had that, so they've always been totally screwed when they had an injury.
What was
You've seen it this year. Heck, they had one game when they had, like, seven guys out on the defense for a game and still managed to compete. And
who was who played the other night? It was in San Francisco and who?
Was it Washington? No, who they
no,
played?
It was a... No, they played somebody, but they... They were talking about somebody got hurt at left tackle and he was out, and this guy played like his first NFL game, and they said he graded out last week as like one of the top three tackles on that particular Sunday, and it was his first game he ever played. He was a scrub, not a scrub, but he wasn't even starting. It was reserved.
And, you know, they may vary. And this is sort of like, you know, we'll go back to Ozzie Trapillo for the Bears. And first of all, they were starting Theo Benedet, who was a rookie from the Canadian League. And he was, you know, keeping his head above water or, you know, treading water at the position. When he got hurt, then they moved Trapillo, who was their second round draft pick in. And he's been pretty good since then. You know, they still have to give both of those guys some help, and that may have been the case with the San Francisco starter, where you're saying, yeah, I have to give him some help. He'll still grade out really high, but I do have to give him some help against, you know, in certain situations. And, you know, that's and the way teams are doing that, because as you discussed, how many guys can you get in the pattern? One of the ways they're doing that is that it's become very popular to play two tight ends. And now you don't know which one I'm going to keep in and which one I'm going to send out in the pattern, but we're going to do that, and we're going to give our guy some assistance so that he, you know, isn't stuck out there trying to block a premier defensive lineman all by himself. He's not ready for that.
Well, I mean, because there's a lot to it. I just, the money part of it kind of gets to me, because I think they really are, they're in this whatever class it's going to be. It's like the people used to go to the gladiator fights, right? I mean, whatever it is, this upper class is going to be, this is going to be their solution, and the rest of the world is going to watch it on TV and throw money at you through gambling, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I tell you what, this is why I don't do much sports gambling, Kevin. I thought that 21 points on James Madison was the biggest sucker bet I've ever seen. Where I'm saying, how is it only 21 points? They're going to lose like by 50 or something. And sure enough, they were down, what were they down, 30-3 or something the first half, and they came back and covered.
They showed a little bit of fight.
Yeah, they came back and covered. I just thought those guys, once they were down that much, they were going to throw it in, and they didn't. Boy, the Oregon fans got to be pissed off. They lost that bet, huh?
Well, the bettors lost, but you know, I'll also say, it kind of, you know, it craps up your game. You know, you sit there and go, ooh, I don't like what I'm seeing here. You know, is that going to show up as a vulnerability in, and that's really the question: is did JMU expose some vulnerabilities in the Oregon team?
Oh, maybe did he pull all his starters? Maybe he did. I didn't watch. Was up against the Bear game.
I didn't either, because I don't really care. You know, it'll get more interesting, in the next round. But
2 minutes to the half hour.
Yeah, break. We have a. We're gonna take a break here at the end because there's some stuff going on today. Not very much, but it's a holiday week, and usually we kind of trend up in the holiday week. Today we're down a little bit, but we were up yesterday. We did have the one Christmas Eve. I'm gonna say like a decade ago, we were down like 600 points, but I sure as hell don't expect anything like that today. Now, today, for those that don't know, it's a half a day. Friday is a full day. So do you think the police are I was telling Jimmy this story on the way in, I tell you, Kevin, I was calling 911 on the way in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder. I haven't heard anything from the police saying that they found somebody. I don't think they even care. It's really something. Whatever. SP futures down 2, NASDAQ futures down 1. Come back. We'll talk a little bit more about where we think the economy's going a little bit next year. Kevin, think about the 4.3% GDP growth that was announced yesterday. I don't know where that came from. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization,
Jerry,
that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives.
Jerry?
Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Listen, are you a 50-year-old person looking for term life insurance? Then you need to talk to Bob. Bob specializes in helping people find $1 million or more of term life insurance for a couple of $100 a month. Look, you need to know there's a price war in the term life insurance business, and you may be paying too much. Call Bob, and he'll shop and see how much money he can save you. Look, this could be the last term life insurance policy you ever have. Your rates are guaranteed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rates for the next 20 years. And if you're a smoker or your health is not perfect, Bob has great rates for you too. So for $1 million of term life insurance coverage for a couple of $100 a month, call Bob right now. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. That's 800-989-1415. Paid for by Term Direct.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
And we're back.
Hello, welcome back, Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Jim Lawler on the board. SP futures down a buck. NASDAQ futures up 3. So, like I said, there's not much happening on this Christmas Eve. By the way, Merry Christmas to everybody. Dow futures down 35. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 56.2%. Actually, they are not open today. They are closed Christmas Eve. Okay, now the FTSE is open. They're down 18 points, 0.2%. The CAC is also open. They're down 27 cents. Call that flat. The DAX is not open. The last trade was yesterday. Nikkei is open. They're down 68.1%. Hang Seng is open. They're up 44. That's 0.1. Shanghai up 20.5. So, like I say, there's not much going on. Bonds unchanged at 4.16. They've been right about there. They're right about there for 3 rate cuts. So, as they do more rate cuts, doesn't necessarily mean that the 10-year is going down or mortgage rates are going down. So, be careful with that. Oil. Up 15 cents, 58.53. We've got gold up 360. It was up a little more, but over 4,500, 4,509. Who'd have thunk that? Silver up 56 cents, 71.70. I went back on some of our trades from a couple of years ago. I had people long silver, and it went from 28 to 29 in a whole year. Now it's 71. It's really, really something. Copper up 3 cents, 559 foreign exchange. The amount of dollars going in the system. Dollar is up. Euro's almost up to 118 on the dollar, so the dollar keeps heading south, because if the Fed keeps cutting rates, pour more money in the system, guess what? More dollars versus the same amount of pounds. The pound goes up, the dollar goes down. Duh. British pound, 135, so it's over 135, which, again, has been recently pretty high. Crypto down 767, 87,055. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Well, we do have traffic. Inbound Kennedy to the Montrose is now at 9 minutes. The Edens Expressway inbound from Lake Cook is 21. The Eisenhower inbound from Wolf is 14. And the Dan Round inbound from 95th to the Jane Byrne is 12 minutes. In regards to sports, we had the Bulls play last night. They beat the Atlanta Hawks 126 to 123. We had two bowl games, Louisville over Toledo 27-22 and Western Kentucky over Southern Miss 27-16. And for weather, it is not bad in Chicago. It is about 41 degrees with a high of 44 and a low of 38. Rain and drizzle tonight. And in our Phoenix area, it is 64 degrees with a high of 75 with a couple of showers. Back to you, Chief.
Kevin just got a text. The girl downstairs did, in fact, get her window busted up. She's not happy. Where do you go get new windows on Christmas Eve?
AutoZone. Oh,
what's that, people who say they come to you?
Well, we know on a regular day, you'd go down and visit our buddy. Remember Jackie Putz? We played ball with him at Southside. They own M&M Glass. Those are the best guys to go. I wonder if they're open today, but I suppose I should give everybody a number and tell Jackie you know us, and you always get a nice deal. They did a beautiful job on my my truck when I got it. The leather seat was all messed up, and man, oh, man. And, of course, they gave me an estimate, and then they charged me less. And I go, Jackie, what are you doing? It's not even as much as the estimate. You did twice as much work. He goes, well, that's why I don't have a house in Florida. Merry Christmas. Okay. good people, but yeah, it's boy, talk about an inconvenience. The good news is it's not raining or snowing, I guess. But so people don't need that, do they? It's just not something you want to have happen. But next year, question on the what do you think of oil? Oil's been it's down here below $60. It's been there for quite some time. Tommy Shanahan sent me a list of why the oil is down that low, and there's countries that, you know, you didn't even know existed are all of a sudden popping out a million barrels of oil a week or a month or something. So it's really become a market where there's all kinds of countries that are exporting oil. And I think you probably got a little bit of demand slowdown maybe here or in China. I don't think the world economy is doing what everybody thinks it's doing. So you see oil at this level. Now, every time it threatens to go over 100, Kevin, everybody says it's going to keep going. Every time it gets below 60, people say it's going to keep going, and never really does. The XLE hasn't gone down as much as the oil prices itself. XLE is the oil piece of the S&P 500. There's 9 or 10 little S&Ps. If you add them all up, you get the big S&P. So if you want to zero in on healthcare, you do the XLV. If you want to do banking, you do the XLF. But oil, you do the XLE. And there's other stuff. There's a manufacturing piece and everything else. My question is, what do you think? I've had people in gold and silver now for 3-4 years, and this year I just wish we had every single dime in gold and silver, and we didn't. It's done nothing but make money for everybody the last 6 months, like no investment I've ever had for anybody. And now, do I really want to keep everybody in GDX at $90 when I thought it was a great buy at 30. I don't know, Kevin. If the administration and the government, succeeding administrations, keep pushing dollars out there, it might just be starting. But I think somewhere along the line here, you're going to get an inflation number that they can't hide from. and you're going to see your long-term rates go up. There's going to have to be a reckoning someplace. But if there is, God, I'm 10 years too late on that. What do you think?
Well, I think you're going to see, what are we going to see next year? First of all, if we're pushing towards 14 million barrels a day of production. So if that continues for any amount of time, and it's been going up every month this year, and really started going up some last year. In fact, we got by the end of last year we were 13 and a half million barrels a day. So if we start, if we continue to produce it that much, that's gonna, have an effect on oil prices that's positive. And if you, if you keep the price of fuel down, then you get, you give a lot of industries a lot of cost relief. Because fuel is such an important part of,
we've been in the 13 millions for kind of quite a while now. So we're up to like 13.
Yeah, we've been in the 13 millions. I think we crossed it in late 2023.
It was kind of heading straight up in the first Trump administration. Then with the COVID, it came flying down. And then under Biden, once the COVID was kind of over, it started shooting back up again and actually reached a higher peak than it was in the first Trump administration. But if there wasn't a COVID, I got to believe it would have kept going straight up the whole way. But
it might have. But if we go back and we start looking at 2017, only in late 2017 did we get over 10 million barrels a day, and that was in November, and then it fell under 10 million in December. And then, kind of went 10 point something and was rising in 2018. So that's where we were. It wasn't 13 million at that point. We probably would have been headed in that direction. But then when we got to 2021, it fell, although it didn't, it didn't completely crash. We saw under 10 million barrels once, but now, it was 2021 was 11.4, and so on. So it was holding steady at that point. I think right now, you're seeing more, and part of that is because there's just more demand for it. If we keep doing that and keep oil prices low, that's a good thing. You're going to see some, tax benefits for people, tips, Social Security, those kinds of things that are going to put a little more money in people's pockets, and they're going to put more money in the people's pockets who spend what they get. I don't think that's going to translate into savings, unfortunately, but it will. But you also have some business incentives that are going to kick in. I think probably the biggest one is that if you construct new facilities, you're going to have a very accelerated depreciation schedule for it. So there's going to be a lot of tax benefit into building capacity. So we may see some real growth in those areas. Now, whether that's going to keep up with the inflationary pressure, remains to be seen.
Well, these guys, we have people like to take credit for everything. We always have people like that. We got a star of the show today, but if you look at these numbers, it's more a question of supply and demand. With the exception of this fracking continues to get more and more efficient, it appears. The big problem with that now is that it's not necessarily the more oil you get from the fracking, you get light sweet. If you're a conspiracy theorist, you wonder why we're messing around with Venezuela to the amount we are. We've got like 10 refineries that are set up for essentially Venezuelan, crummy Canadian, maybe Saudi oil, and they're pretty much sitting dormant. And if we double our amount of fracking oil, it doesn't mean we have the refinery capacity for it, because refineries are set up for certain types of oil, and there aren't a whole lot left over that can do the light oil. But if you look back here, under George Bush, was, I guess most people would say Bush too, was very pro oil. I think the oil production was down while he was in. I guess what I'm saying is, despite people, snorting on this, it's the industry, I think, is bigger than the White House over any 4 or 10 year period. But you know what's interesting, Kevin, is you look at the field production is going to be 13.8, which is you just mentioned accurately, by the way. You know what the actual production is?
What's that?
It's 20.2 million.
Okay. What's the discrepancy there?
It took me 3 days to find it, by the way, because if you look and say how much oil does the U.S. consume per day and how much do they drill, we consume like 20.1 million barrels and we drill like 20.2. So we got like 100,000 barrels a day, maybe 300,000 barrels a day surplus, which we've never really had before for like a long time. But I didn't realize that the crude oil, like you're talking about, is in the 13s. But then we get 2.8 million barrels of ethane, 2.2 million barrels of propane, and something called normal butane, isobutane, and something called natural gasoline, whatever that is. So there's actually another 7 million barrels a day of like other stuff that isn't crude oil. I had no idea that what do we do with 3 million
that
barrels?
That is used for things like heating and so on, isn't it?
I don't what do you use ethane for? I know propane people use that. I know what that's for, but
yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know enough about it.
So what is the difference between normal butane and abnormal butane? Well, there's isobutane.
The abnormal butane is just weird. You just can't make it behave.
Yeah, isobutane must be the non-normal. And I'm dying to find out what natural gasoline is. But anyway, so we actually have, it's more than 13 million barrels of oil, like you and I would describe oil. There's another 7 of other stuff. Plus there's natural gas too, right? That comes off of this stuff. So we're energy-wise, we're in pretty good shape, it seems to me, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think that is important for economic growth. So we will see what happens, especially if it's inexpensive, because you know if you were to go for a lot of manufacturing, especially, and say you know what are the top 3 or 4 expenditures? Well, you're going to see obviously people. Is a big one, acquisition of parts. But when you talk about acquisition of materials and parts, a lot of what you're discussing in there is transportation as well. So if transportation's cheaper, that's good. A lot of the transportation deals that large companies cut have to do with they have kickers built in, so it's really tied to the price of oil rather than being a fixed cost for the term of the contract. Nowadays, that's a lesson people learned a long time ago. The providers want protection when it goes up, when the cost goes up, and to get it, they have been negotiating protection for the buyers to say, but I get some benefit when the price goes down.
Well, yeah, but what do you? We've talked a lot on the education end. And Larissa and Russell were talking about it last week, and we heard from our friend Bill Moriarty maybe 6 weeks ago that there's not a lot of people that are going into civil engineering. Because you could still, if you wanted to build a dam tomorrow, you could do it, because they're building dams all over the world, and these engineering places have 40,000 people working for them, so could they do it? Yeah. But in terms of people aren't looking for that as a terrific career. And, I'm not so sure that being a civil engineer for even the state of Illinois, supervising road repairs and everything, isn't a pretty damn nice job, Kevin. I guess it's not sexy. How many people do you think are going for oil field engineering? I mean, a lot of those, from what I understand, down in the South, Bill was telling me, a lot of the people who work the oil fields are from Mexico. I don't know that people go work. When they first started the thing up in Montana or North Dakota, wasn't all kinds of young people running up there to make $50 an hour and live in a big Winnebago for 6 months? And is that still happening, or is it just all? Is it? I mean, who's doing all this work? I guess my question. I haven't heard anybody go work out.
It hasn't gotten the kind of publicity that it did before. So I would love to see that answer myself, because we saw that during the recession in 2008, 2009, that there was a big migration to you know, to places like North Dakota and Permian Basin and so on, because there, you know, it was, you know, we were in the fracking boom, and there were lots of work available, and so all these people who were laid off in Rust Belt industries were instead finding work elsewhere, and they were migrating, and that was simultaneously we had the housing crunch, and so they were underwater on their homes anyway, so they were just walking away from those, and interesting phenomenon. I don't know the answer to it for employment. I do know the answer is that a whole lot of people are getting away from the traditional college degree type of programs. You know, that there is less participation in that and more participation in the kinds of training that people need to actually go do jobs where you get your hands on and work.
Well, some of that, you know, we've tried to touch a couple different spots in the show in that. One is, you know, there's the get dirty part, but there also is the part that those industries, especially in some areas like Chicago, you know, have shown that they suck over a lifetime of work. I mean, there's always going to be lawyers, you would think, or maybe we shouldn't, but we do. Doesn't mean you're always going to have manufacturing on the south side. Now, you know, because one of the guys here in the building, a good friend of mine, his daughter, he's Hispanic. They're all citizens before the ICE comes running over here. He's Hispanic, and his daughter married a student down in Texas. And I think they live somewhere, and he and three or four other guys pile in his car, and they drive to the oil fields, which is, you know, a couple hundred miles away. And I think they're 3 weeks on, 1 week off, something like that, Kevin. And they all drive back. They all spend a week with their family, and then they go back again. And, you know, that's a lifestyle that is different. I'm saying a lot of people wouldn't like it. I mean, Bill Moriarty talked about when you put in this, you know, big water treatment plant, it might be or either treatment one way or the other, either to make it drinking water or to take the other stuff and make it so you can put it back in the river. Because that might be a 3-4 year project where all these workers work there, and all of a sudden, well, Bill was doing that when he was designing them. And all of a sudden, you know, you're in California, and guess what? Your next job's in Florida. And everybody goes there, and they hang for, it's like being in an Army base, for God's sake. They go 3-4 years, and the guy works there, and the kids go to school there, and it's a lifestyle that I think most people that go to Notre Dame or Wisconsin or Illinois or Michigan or someplace probably would rather not have. You know, and it's not that you don't make any money. It's not like it isn't interesting work. It's just is, you know, it's not. Some people say I'm not doing that. I mean, I wonder how much of, if it's the salary, is it the vacation, is it the health care, is it the, do I really want to be away from my family? I mean, you know, you have a couple of kids, and you know the difference between, you know, having a baby where your wife's got two sisters and her mom and three aunts in the neighborhood versus not. I mean, it's a big difference. It's a different world, isn't it? There's a lot more to this that goes into meets the eye, isn't there?
Well, yeah, it is all about lifestyle. That's a really important factor in what anybody chooses to do as a career. But I think you're also finding a lot of different motivators. So, you know, we're getting away from that everybody should go to college no matter what. Well, there's a difference between choosing to go get a college degree in something and wanting to become a lifelong learner. You know, I was talking about the same course I developed. You know, one of the things that we do at the end is we identify the skills that you're going to need to be successful in 2035, and say, what's your plan? What's your plan to get there? What's your plan to be ready for that, and to be able to thrive in that environment? Those skills are not necessarily, certainly not a liberal education model, but they are partly, because if you're not a critical thinker, if you're not adaptable, if you can't do some research and come up with recommendations and all that, then you're not going to be successful. And that's true. That's as true in the future as it is today. But it's but you're also going to have to be a little more adaptive in terms of the lifestyle if you want to succeed, because we do have various forms of automation. And what's changed is, historically, automation has bumped people off of the factory floor or off of the warehouse floor. Now it's bumping people out of the offices. And that's a significant, you know, a significant change that's accelerating now. And so, you know, when you start to say, okay, how are you going to be ready to be successful in, you know, in the next round of that, then you have to start, you know, you have all those skills, but you also have to, you know, be willing to put your hands on things.
Well, I don't disagree. What, I ran into, we don't want to talk too much about our alma mater, but I ran into some guy the other night, and I mean, you know, I graduated a long time ago, and so did Kevin, and every school has its kind of its spot, or it's a, whatever you want to call it, its reason for being. And when Kevin and I went to Notre Dame, and I think you're finding this in a lot of things, it was basically a blue-collar kind of place for kids who went to Catholic school, not everybody. From South Side of Chicago, Minneapolis, wherever you went, Minnesota, they went, and you had to be pretty smart. You didn't have to be a genius, and everybody went there. And now, all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but over a period of time, it's not that anymore. I mean, I walk by the place, and I feel like I'm a purple thumb sticking out. I mean, everybody else has got, you know, buku money. Not that, you know, I have a couple nickels, but I don't. Now it's become 1% or you. Very.
I think to a degree it's become that, but they also, you know, I think they're more focused, frankly, on the, what I want to say, on getting the bookworm, to getting the nerd, in there. That, you know, they're basically locked in on chasing the U.S. News and World Report rankings. Which is, you know, if you're a Catholic school, is kind of a futile endeavor, because, you know, there's a built-in bias against religious schools in evaluating, you know, the academic worth of them. So I think it's, you know, it's a futile cause, but it's I agree with you that in many ways they've lost that identity. It used to be a good place for normal people to go, as well as people who were not normal like you and me.
Well, I ran into a allegedly normal guy down. Well, I've known the guy forever. I mean, there's a couple of groups that a couple nights a week end up in the bar downstairs in our building. And these guys, back in COVID, there were two tables. There were these guys and there was us, because there were only two tables that were in 8 feet of the door back in the COVID days. Anyway, both of our groups should own shares in the place, right? Because we kept them alive. Anyway, I was talking to one of the guys, and he's a big Fenwick guy, and he's saying, you know, and I think he's a Dulmer. And he goes, you know, Chief, I know you went to Notre Dame. What's your feel? And I go, yeah, it's not me. And he goes, we had like 8 or 9 guys in Fenwick this year that were on the waiting list. Not one of them got in. Hey, if they don't want us, just tell us. We'll go somewhere else. We'll stop giving them dough. Don't just tell us. We're men. If it's not for us anymore, just say so. You know.
Well, it's and you're right, and that's a significant change. And, you know, what have we seen in other schools? You know, how many foreign students does Illinois want to bring in because they get full tuition from them? You know, everybody's got their different motivations for changing the flavor of the college. But, you know, I find it, I'm around campus a lot. I'm around alumni a lot, including some younger alumni. So I still think it's, Notre Dame, as John Flanagan once told me, they still produce a lot of really good people. I remember, and this goes back to college days with John, and I was bitching about something or other, and he said, yeah, but you got a grant that Notre Dame produces a lot of really great people, so they must be doing something right. And,
they had some incredibly dedicated teachers. I mean, I was never in big love with the administration, but the teachers I had were one better than the next.
And they, yeah, I may have told the J.T. Croteau story on the air before when J.T. was an economics professor, you know, very quirky guy, but, you know, really accomplished a economist. And he walked into class one day and he was fuming. And he kind of throws his books on the desk, you know, just shit. And it about, you know, 2-3 times he started to say something and then thought better of it and didn't. And finally, he just says, you know, every institution has its share of idiots. Here, they all seem to have gravitated to administration.
What did Dr. McCoy say in Star Trek? The bureaucratic mind has been a constant through the ages.
Yeah.
It's a, well, we hope everybody's going to have a good Christmas. Again, we will be here Friday. The you wonder, though, Kevin, you know, we obviously were locked in on one place because that's where we went. I wonder if we had somebody, you know, on that went, say, to Michigan. I know my group at Ohio State, all my Italian family's from Columbus, and they all went to Ohio State, and they're all, you know, all went to engineering. One guy was 5 years in aerospace engineering, dropped that brilliant dude, nicest guy. And he goes, all you had to do was be able to walk across campus, chew gum, and basically not trip, and you got in. Well, now they've got their antics there. If you apply for Ohio State, if you're not one of the upper crust people, they send you to like Ohio Northern or Ohio Western or something. And of the people in there, they can't wait to get the Michigan people in because they pay full bore. And then we've had somebody on the air who's now retired that was one of the admissions department at Michigan. We can't wait to get people from Ohio in here. They pay full bore. So Michigan's trying to steal the Ohio people because they pay more. Ohio's trying to state that. And I would bet that you could probably get one of my cousins or somebody who went to Ohio State 30 years ago and say the tone has changed here, and who's here and who you meet and what the cost is to be here and can you afford an apartment and is it fun, and I bet there's changes all over, not just in South Bend.
Yeah, I would agree with you, and you know, that I think that's, you know, that's the nature of it. And you know, the other thing is you get people who are moving away from college to do more, you know, trade-oriented stuff. You're probably seeing a shift in the makeup of the student body in that regard as well. You know, when I go back to the more normal people, I don't mean to disparage those who go to college. I did. I have a master's degree. You have a master's degree. So it's not like, you know, I'm anti-education. I'm very much immersed in it. But you know, the kinds of things. I tell you what I get from my students all the time is they think a big part of their education is hearing the stories from people like me. You know, in other words, they want to know what it's like when they go to work. You know, so they say to me, Kevin, I can read. You know, you don't have to regurgitate the chapter material to me. I want to hear from a practical matter. You know, what's it going to take for me to be successful? What's it going to be like when I go to work? And so, you know, my students are very much oriented towards that because they are often trade oriented, or, you know, there are IT people who, you know, who may or may not go for a 4-year degree, but nevertheless, they're going to be out there working, and when you're a technician, you don't necessarily feel compelled to get into management. So you know, a lot of this is, you know, are you putting people on a management track? And you know, I still think it's important. You know, we talk about things you need to be successful in the future. You know, leadership is one of them, but leadership doesn't necessarily mean management.
Well, we don't really have a difference here, but we got a dash here. But if for instance, my stepfather would have owned a huge plumbing company, and it was mine for the taking, mine and my brother's, the price we paid to go to Notre Dame and the University of Chicago, I still would have gone. Who says the head of a plumbing company can't have a master's degree or have an economics degree from Notre Dame? At the price it was, you'd be foolish not to take it, because all my years after then, I've never felt intimidated at a meeting. I never had some consultant come in and say, who started talking about something I knew nothing about. it to me, it was exceptionally worth it. Now, today, if one course at the University of Chicago is more than I spent for 2 years, and Notre Dame is $80,000, the total package that I took right now, Kevin, would have to be, what, 320 plus another 150? We're talking $470,000. That's a whole different... My total package was 20. Not even. 18. And I can work on weekends. Yeah. It's not the idea that go make money as a plumber, don't go to college. It's what are we doing? We've just priced...
And the thing is, Tom, now you can. There's a lot of colleges that focus on micro-credentials, so you don't necessarily have to get a degree to get the education that you need to be successful running the plumbing right. company or something else. I think we have more options available. It's not that they were never available. I think more options have become acceptable to people.
What I'm saying is the idea that you moved away from your parents for 4 years. You met people from all around the country. You learned to live on your own, make your own decisions. There's a reward to that, I think, when you're 18 years old. I would have been a much better manager of the plumbing company doing what I did than if I wouldn't have gone, I think. There was a reward to that. I'm saying now it's just too friggin' expensive.
There is, although, again, living on campus at Notre Dame is not like the real world. But I lived off campus 2 years, and that was more like the real world. I had a job off campus. I think that's what I see in my student body makeup is that I get people who have families, they have jobs, and they have school, and they're really that takes an incredible amount of dedication, and it's an impressive amount of dedication actually. In that regard, it's impressive, what the people accomplish, and some of them are going to go on, and they are going to, go to one of the local colleges, or some of them are, I've had students, go down to Indiana University is for their last 2 years.
Yeah, but your issue is once we all graduated, you had nobody cool to hang around with. That's why you moved off campus.
That was it, or because that group of older people, they couldn't bust us all, but once we were down to a few of us, then retribution could come.
God. Anyway, Merry Christmas to everybody, and remember, you're Stacks and Jacks listeners, so if you go to church and they pass the hat, put something in, don't take something out, right, Kevin?
You got it.
See everybody on Friday. SP Futures unchanged. NASDAQ Futures up a buck, so you're missing nothing there. So enjoy the day. So there I was.
Rocking around your Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every couple tries to stop. Rocking around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas spirit ring. Later we'll have some pumpkin pie and we'll do some caroling. You will get a sentimental feeling when you hear voices singing, let's be jolly, deck the halls with boughs of holly. Christmas tree, have a happy holiday. Everyone dancing merrily in the new old-fashioned way. Holiday. Everyone.